expansion of ties among independent nations. Ebrahim Raisi was meeting with Algerian Parliament Speaker Ebrahim Bougali in Tehran. He said Iran and Algeria can enhance constructive cooperation for the benefit of their own nations and the Muslim community based on common views. Raisi added Iran has been able to turn sanctions and foreign pressure into opportunities. The Algerian official for his part said his country is willing to improve economic ties with Tehran. Iran's Ministry of Economic Affairs and Finance has held the country's first conference on combating money laundering and financing terrorism in the capital, Tehran. Over 300 managers from different institutions have attended the seminar. Matthew Abbasian has your details.
Money laundering. Simply put, it means one conceals the origin of the money obtained from illicit activities. The term money laundering is said to have its origins in the U.S. in the 1920s and 30s. Most gangsters, such as Al Capone, used laundries as a cover for the illegal money they made because the amount of cash flowing into laundry operations was challenging to track. This way, large sums of money could be processed without being noticed. Governments have been dealing with this issue for decades, working hard to put an end to it. In 2008, Iran established the Economy Ministry's Financial Intelligence Unit, or FIU, headed by the country's economy minister for this purpose. On Tuesday, the FIU held Iran's first national anti-money laundering and financing terrorism conference in the capital, Tehran. Over 300 senior managers from different institutions took part in this seminar to discuss strengthening and developing necessary infrastructure to prevent and deal with corruption, especially money laundering. Speaking on the sidelines of the conference, Iran's economy minister Ehsan Khandouzi said the Islamic Republic has higher standards in blocking the path of money laundering and financing terrorism compared to many countries in the world.
According to the financial and judicial reports, important measures have been taken in Iran in the field of fighting against money laundering and financing terrorism, which is unprecedented. We expect the FATF working group to adopt a technical approach in its evaluation instead of a political approach.
Khandouzi also pointed to Iran's membership at the Financial Action Task Force, saying Tehran's position in the FATF is active, not passive. Organizers of the conference say it has provided a perfect platform for the senior managers of Iranian organizations to achieve synergy in combating money laundering.
Keeping Iran's financial system healthy is one of the priorities of the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi. In this regard, Tehran has been taking serious steps to combat money laundering and deal with disruptors of the economy. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
The Iraqi anti-terror movement has taken the lid off U.S. plans for maintaining military presence in the Arab country. The Secretary General of the Asaib al-Haq movement said main goal of American military presence in Iraq is to ensure the security of the Israeli regime. Sheikh Qais al-Khazali said the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the country is inevitable since the country is capable of defending itself. He blamed the former Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadimi for failing to take any real steps to end the American combat presence in Iraq. U.S. has kept 2,500 soldiers in the country under the pretext of assisting local forces in combating Daesh terrorists. This comes against the backdrop of growing calls for the complete withdrawal of all American troops from the country. The Hamas Political Bureau chief says there is neither diplomatic nor a security solution in the occupied West Bank after a so-called peace process between Palestinians and Israelis failed. Ismail Haniyeh said the only solution now is for the Israeli regime to leave Palestinian land, including Al-Quds. Haniyeh said the Israeli way of death and destruction will never work with the Palestinian people. He said the violations in the West Bank and a settlement expansion, as well as Judaization designs, will be met with stronger resistance. An agreement was reached between Israelis and Palestinians in the 1993 Oslo Accord, aimed at fulfilling the right of Palestinians to self-determination. But the regimes constantly violated the deal, that is, since the year 2000. And Palestinians in Gaza have staged a rally to mark the 54th anniversary of the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Israeli regime. People in the blockaded enclave have vowed to use all forms of resistance to help defend the holy site. Here's more.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a rally in the east of Gaza City near the security fence with the Israeli regime to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. 54 years ago, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Al-Quds was set on fire by an Australian Zionist named Dennis Michael Rohan in coordination with the Israeli regime forces. The rally was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The Hamas movement vowed to continue fighting for the sake of Al-Aqsa.
This big event east of Gaza is sending a strong message to the Zionist entity regarding Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Aqsa today is facing a much greater danger than it did 54 years ago. We will continue our struggle and our fight to protect the Islamic and Arab identity of Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Aqsa is a red line that must not be crossed.
People also marched towards the security fence, which resulted in clashes with Israeli regime forces. Israeli forces opened fire at the peaceful protesters and injured eight of them.
On the 54th anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque, we stress that the Palestinian resistance will always defend it. We call on Palestinians, especially in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, to defend Al-Aqsa against Zionist settlers and forces.
Soon after the arson attack, the Israeli regime increased the Judaization and settlement building in Al-Quds. Palestinians emphasized that Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always remain at the heart of the Palestinian struggle against the Israeli occupation.
We will not allow the Zionist regime to continue its violations against Al-Aqsa, and we will use all forms of resistance to protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa. The Zionists aim to ethnically cleanse Al-Quds from Palestinians and to Judaize the holy city.
Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state.
Palestinians say they are willing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, despite the U.S.-Israeli plots against the holy city. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Dozens of Israeli settlers have attacked Palestinian vehicles near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Settlers near towns of Berga and Sebastina, prior to the road linking Jenin to Nablus, they pelted stones at passing Palestinian cars. Locals say a number of vehicles were damaged. Settlers also raided a home in the area amid heavy live fire by regime troops. The Palestinian families, homes, and farms have been targeted by Israeli settlers, some of them armed. And now many workers in Britain are grappling with the cost of living crisis as wages are squeezed by rising prices. Nonetheless, new research shows their bosses, the biggest companies, saw a pay rise of almost 16% on average last year. Median pay for bosses of the UK's 100 biggest listed firms was more than £3.9 million in 2022, up from nearly £3.4 million the previous year. That, according to research by the High Pay Center think tank, this sends average earnings to 118 times more than a typical UK worker. UK has been rocked by public and private sector walkouts for months. British employees are demanding pay increases proportionate to inflation, but the government has so far failed to meet their demands. And bankruptcies in the European Union have reached their highest since 2015, fueling concerns the 27-nation bloc could be facing a new financial crisis. Business operators claim they are not receiving enough government support. Jerome Hughes reports out of Brussels.
On almost every commercial street in the Belgian capital, there is evidence of failed businesses. The country's statistics office recorded 1,092 bankruptcies in June alone. Bridi Said has been in business for 30 years. He says things have never been so tough.
Difficult to find the rent. Rent is expensive and a lot of things together, and the war, sure, and the war.
Across the 27 countries that make up the EU, bankruptcies increased by 8% in April, May and June compared to the previous 3 months. That's according to Eurostat, the bloc's statistical office, which says the increases are at their highest since it began collating such data in 2015. We've raised the issue with the European Commission.
What are the EU authorities doing to try and support these firms under pressure?
The answer was, we'll get back to you with a response. Many analysts say high inflation and rising interest rates are happening in the EU because sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. The bloc is sending deadly weapons worth billions of euro to Ukraine amid growing calls for peace talks. This is a subject we also asked the bloc's executive arm about.
Is there a realisation within the EU that, you know, this current war as it stands, it's unwinnable?
Hopefully they will win. Hopefully they will win soon. We are supporting Ukraine. We will support Ukraine for as long as it gets. Of course we want to see peace, but the peace needs to be on Ukrainian terms.
The EU released a further 1.5 billion euro to the Ukrainian government on Tuesday. Back home, the social crisis is deepening and millions are struggling to pay their mortgages due to interest rate hikes. The knock-on effect of bankruptcies could be disastrous, experts warn. If unemployment rises sharply, which many business insiders say now seems inevitable, extra pressure will be placed on already strained social welfare systems. An unprecedented economic crisis could be in store for the EU. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russia says it could annex Georgia's regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia that Moscow recognized as independent in 2008. Deputy Chair of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, said the idea of joining Russia is still popular in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. He made the remarks in an article marking the 15th anniversary of the recognition of the two regions' independence. Medvedev also pointed the finger at the West for fueling tensions in Georgia through its potential admission into NATO. The Russian official said Moscow will not wait if its concerns become closer to reality. Georgia lost control over the regions after the collapse of the former Soviet Union. The country's attempt to regain control of South Ossetia after independence led to a counterattack by Russia. Number of gun-related child deaths in the U.S. has hit a new record. That, according to a study by the American Academy of Pediatrics Association, or the AAP, using the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's mortality database, the AAP journal found more than 4,700 children died from gun-related injuries in 2021. That's a latest year for which data is available. Number of deaths the previous year were fewer than 4,300 and in 2019 below 3,400. Study also shows that black children accounted for about 67% of firearms homicides in 2021. Data makes gun violence number one cause of death for children in the U.S. since 2020. This as numerous moves by some lawmakers to push for stricter gun laws have had no tangible results. Japan has announced it will begin releasing a nuclear-contaminated water from the Fukushima power plant into the sea as early as Thursday, sparking backlash throughout Asia and beyond. In Seoul, South Korean environmental groups and supporters have voiced some strong opposition, Frank Smith reports.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida toured the water treatment facility of the Fukushima power plant on Sunday. Tuesday, the Tokyo Electric Company announced the plant's contaminated wastewater would be released beginning as early as Thursday.
We will continue to steadily advance the decommissioning process of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant and proceed with the measures dealing with the treated wastewater, while placing the highest priority on safety.
In Seoul, South Korean activists scuffled with riot police trying to contain their protest. Protesters argue that the measures to dispose of the water should be investigated and warn of the risks of the impending ocean release.
When the nuclear contaminated water is discharged into the ocean, it will spread around the entire world. Even if there is no problem for now, in the long term, it could cause radiation exposure and destroy the ocean ecosystem.
Since the nuclear accident in 2011, water used to cool the nuclear reactor's molten core has been stored, with available tank space nearing full capacity.
The South Korean government's response to Japan's plan to release the nuclear-contaminated water from the Fukushima power plant has been muted. President Yoon Suk-yeol has prioritized strengthening the country's alliance with the United States and Japan at the expense of the environment.
While the environmental damage of the release of the wastewater may be severe, fishers in Japan and the region are also concerned about reputational damage. Opposition South Korean lawmakers have objected that the president's priorities are confused.
Of course, the Japanese government can lie for their sake and for TEPCO. But why is Yoon Suk-yeol's administration representing the Japanese government and TEPCO rather than our people?
Japan's release of the nuclear wastewater is scheduled to take decades to complete. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iran's foreign minister has reacted to reports on U.S. unloading an Iranian oil tanker. Vessel was seized 2.5 months ago. Tehran's blasted the move as an aggression against Iranian tankers that amounts to piracy and a violation of international law.
The U.S. has reportedly begun unloading cargo from a seized tanker which is believed to have been transporting Iranian oil to Singapore. Suez Rajan, the oil tanker, has sat off the coast of Texas since May. Last week, a group of American lawmakers implored the Biden administration to end the impasse and offload the tanker. Ship tracking data analyzed by American news agency The Associated Press showed the oil tanker started ship-to-ship transfer of its cargo to another tanker, the MR Euphrates, some 70 kilometers southeast of Houston. The cargo aboard that vessel is estimated to be 800,000 barrels of oil, with an estimated value of $56 million. The spokesperson for the Iranian Foreign Ministry declined to confirm the report but warned the U.S. that his country won't remain silent on the violation of its rights. Nasser Kanani slammed the measures that involved attacking oil tankers carrying Iranian oil as a brazen example of piracy. He said the general principle is that the era of hit and run has been over. The spokesman emphasized that the Islamic Republic won't remain silent on any violation of the Iranian nation's rights, will show an appropriate reaction, and cut off the hands of violators. Already, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, has warned that those involved in offloading the Suez Rajan's cargo should expect to be struck back. The IRGC's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsidi, warned that Iran would hold any oil company seeking to unload its crude from the vessel responsible. He said Iran would also hold America responsible. Washington has claimed to have hijacked tankers carrying Iranian oil several times, arguing that the ships had been flouting U.S. sanctions. The U.S. usually auctions off Iran's stolen assets, claiming it would use the money to pay damages to alleged victims of the Islamic Republic's actions. Meanwhile, Washington plans to sell the confiscated Iranian oil and use the money for the victims and survivors of the 9/11 Al-Qaeda attacks. Tehran accuses the U.S. of stealing its oil, saying the move is illegal.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن
با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we have made you familiar with the views of British thinker Hamed Algar on Imam Khomeini. Algar, teacher of Islamic studies in Berkeley University of California, believes that the Islamic Revolution would have never triumphed without the leadership of Imam Khomeini. Today, you will get familiar more with his views on the personality of Imam Khomeini. Stay tuned, please. University lecturer Hamed Algar writes that the first Pahlavi ruler, Reza Khan, did his best to isolate religious institutions and depreciate them among the academics. The illiterate king even made every effort to prevent holding of religious sessions all over the country. The great leader of the Islamic Revolution, however, held classes on ethics and very soon attracted a great number of seminary students and ulema. These sessions were so instructive and impressive that many ordinary people, too, took part at the classes, and even people from other cities tried to attend the classes which were held weekly. The brave confrontation of Imam Khomeini with the despotic ruler reached the point that the chief police of the holy city of Qom asked him to stop his classes. But the Imam didn't give in and answered that if the police want to stop the classes, they would have to resort to force. Unable to intimidate Imam Khomeini to give up his classes, the regime's forces tried to derange the classes. Yet this stratagem failed too, as the Imam changed the place of classes from Faizieh school to another one. Hamed Algar says that the outstanding point at Imam Khomeini's ethical classes was his divine motive. He believes that this point was indeed the basic characteristic of the Imam. He writes, "The divine motive was one of the notable features of Imam Khomeini, who led the revolution till victory. He always paid attention to the main source of glory, grandeur, majesty, and power, God." Algar continues that Reza Khan intended to omit Islam in Iran as a political, social, and cultural power. He writes,
This goal had been dictated to him by the imperialist powers, especially Britain, because they deemed ulema in particular and Islam in general as an obstacle for achieving their goals. The British researcher names martyr Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Modarrest as Imam Khomeini's role model and writes, "No doubt, the clergyman who was the role model of a struggle against Reza Khan and put a very deep impact on Imam Khomeini was Sayyid Hassan Modarres. Modarres's opposition against despotism and the foreign hegemony regarding his simple way of living seriously impacted Imam Khomeini." Imam Khomeini considered Modarrest's reaction towards Russia's ultimatum to Iran during the constitutional movement as an example of real religious behavior, so that he referred to it in various speeches, especially in his speech whereby he exposed the totally humiliating and colonialist capitulation bill, which gave legal immunity to thousands of American advisors in the case that they committed any crime in Iran. Algar writes, "Perhaps the most important narration of Modarres, which has been repeated several times by Imam Khomeini, was his opposition to the Russian ultimatum. The Russian forces had advanced up to Qazvin to add to their demands, but Modarres stood up at the parliament against any granting of concession. Imam Khomeini has commented on this. The conduct of a real religious leader must be like this. A slim and a slender man rejects the ultimatum of a powerful government like Russia." The imam, in his historical speech in condemnation of the capitulation bill for the American criminals, has mentioned this event. Undoubtedly, in that case, he felt as his duty to resist against the arrogant hegemony of the U.S., just as Modarres had successfully stood against the demands of Russia 40 years earlier. Imam Khomeini's famous phrase, "America cannot do a damn thing," which he said after capturing the U.S. embassy, the den of espionage, had already been said by him about Modarres' measure to oppose the Russian ultimatum. The imam had said, "The Russians cannot do a damn thing." Like his role model Modarres, he stood against the arrogance of a superpower and brought it to its knees. Dear listeners, next time we will continue with the views of Hamed Algar on Imam Khomeini.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is a wise statement to contemplate upon from Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, prior to his martyrdom, whilst addressing people of feeble faith who go back on their words. "You are missing your chances and losing your lot. The one who breaks his oath breaks it at his own peril. Allah will certainly compensate me if you leave me."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to enliven our heart in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service, dear listeners. We are talking about how to enliven our heart in our Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, it's pretty self-explanatory that in any lifestyle, not only a Islamic lifestyle, we have to have a heart which is alive. Right now, this heart being alive is not necessarily a physical being alive, even though that would help. But what we're talking about here is this heart which is spiritually alive. It is metaphysically alive. It is a heart which is pure. It is clean. It is sincere. In some terms, we find, for example, Shaheed Ayatollah Dastaghayb Shirazi, who very eloquently called it a qalb salim, a healthy, a pure, a good, wholesome heart. This is what we're talking about. And it's not necessarily a physical heart that we're talking about. Now, how do we enliven this heart? As we said, we have to have a heart which is alive in this spiritual, metaphysical sense, if we want to live any kind of lifestyle. You cannot live any kind of lifestyle, whether it be Islamic or un-Islamic, if your heart is not involved in it. So we need to have a heart which is alive if we want to be able to live that Islamic lifestyle which we are all trying to live. So at this point in the program, we have understood that we are going to have a heart which is alive spiritually if we want to live that wholesome, pure Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how we are going to have a heart which is alive, and that too spiritually, in order to live a Islamic lifestyle. So what exactly do we do if we want to have a heart which is alive so that we can live truly a pure Islamic lifestyle? So there's a beautiful tradition from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed Imam, who says that truly our traditions enliven the hearts. And this is, dear friends, what will bring life spiritually to our hearts. That is that we must be intact, we must be connected to, and we must have a relationship with the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. And especially when considering that we want to live a Islamic lifestyle, we learn our Islamic lifestyle from the traditions which are accepted by the religious ulama and, of course, by the Holy Quran. It is these two sources which help us to understand what a Islamic lifestyle is and what help us to really be able to live a Islamic lifestyle. These traditions, they teach us so many different things, so many beautiful things, so many different points, moral, ethical, jurisprudential. It is all there in the Book of Allah, the Holy Quran, and the exposition and explanation and the intricate details of the Holy Quran, which are the traditions. And so finally, if we are going to live this Islamic lifestyle, we're going to have to enliven our hearts, and that can be done via the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Mr. Prime Minister. Part 4.
In the mid-20th century, British and American diplomats traveling to Iran to negotiate oil deals were advised to view Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Viewing Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was regarded as the best way for the foreigners to gain insight on Iran and its politicians. But for the Westerners, this man remained to be the most enigmatic politician of his era. What made Mohammad Mossadegh the greatest politician of his time? What decisions did he make? And what became of him at the end? The bloodiest war in human history has ended. The Second World War's uninvited guests should be leaving the country. However, before they leave Iran, they want to make sure the great treasures beneath the land would be safely taken care of by their elements. The rights to discover, excavate, refine, and export oil belongs exclusively to Britain. They were plundering Iran's vast oil reserves. The Shah dismisses Mossadegh's request right away. Shapur Reporter, a British agent who specialized in psychological operations, under the title of media attaché of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, is in charge of an American-British spy network. Earlier, this network had caused a deadly riot that coincided with Harriman's visit to Tehran in order to raise concerns about the spread of communism in Iran. The network gives money to Iranian papers to publish divisive anti-Mossadegh articles and caricatures to sow discord among members of the Nationalist Front. The United States is searching for channels to pump money into anti-Mossadegh circles. To achieve this purpose, the best option is to renew ties with the merchant family with old links to the MI6. The Rashidian brothers bring more than 10,000 British pounds to Iran that they distribute among politicians and newspapers. The three Rashidian brothers receive help from Ashraf Pahlavi, who had been sent into exile by Mossadegh after the July 21st uprising. The Rashidian brothers seek support from the Tehran Bazaar and the traditional sports centers called Zurhane. The Rashidian brothers were associated to the sports centers through two widely recognized tough guys, Shaban the Brainless and Tayyib Haj Rezai. The Rashidian brothers also held meetings regularly with influential political figures and clergies connected to the royal court. Ernest Peron, the Shah's childhood companion, and court clergyman Hassan Imami, who received a special allowance from the Shah, were among the Rashidian's circle of friends. One of the missions of the Rashidian brothers was to drive a wedge between Kashani and Mossadegh. Britain's other spy network was in the armed forces of Iran. This network comprised of senior military officers who were Anglophiles. Through this network, MI6 has identified the soldiers that were loyal to Britain. Mossadegh was not idle. He officially ordered the British embassy to close its office in Iran. Afterwards, he held a press conference and said this to the reporters. After the British embassy is closed, the number of meetings in preparation of the coup d'etat increases. The U.S. embassy takes on the mission of launching the coup. At this time, Mossadegh still had hopes of receiving aid from the United States. He even reiterated his requests for aid from the U.S. at a press conference. However, there are more than 100 American officers engaged as consultants and advisors in the Iranian Gendarmerie, Air Force, and Army Ground Force, who have their own links. Every year, more than 300 Iranian officers were being sent to the United States for training. Spying activities were left to the American specialists who had entered Iran as part of Truman's Point 4 program. The activities of American and British spies were completed after they had sown the seeds of discord among the leaders of the oil nationalization movement of Iran. Instead of taking action to stop the foreigners' activities, Mossadegh targets a number of Majlis representatives for the suspicious death of police chief Afshar Tus. This became the pretext for a strange decision by the prime minister, which rocked the very foundations of the constitutional system. A general vote to determine the fate of the Majlis not only fails to help Mossadegh consolidate his position, but also turns into a chance to let the national government get targeted. Kermit Roosevelt, a CIA operative, arrives in Iran to officially assume the position of coup d'etat director. He meets with the Shah of Iran to tell him about the coup d'etat plan. The Shah exits Iran on August 16. Before leaving, he informs Kermit Roosevelt that he had relieved Mossadegh from his post and appointed Fazlullah Zahedi as the new prime minister. However, the events do not unfold as they had been planned. After the announcement of the coup d'etat is made, chaos breaks out in the cities all across the country. Mossadegh bans all forms of protests in order to restore law and order. Under direct orders by Roosevelt, the money supplied by the group organizers was distributed among military personnel and street thugs. On the morning of August 19, 1953, anti-Mossadegh rallies were launched.
At the most, and the money that was available there, well, I can't remember, but I think we had, we probably had $700,000 or $800,000 available, of which we used during the course of the operation maybe $10,000.
Are you saying that only $10,000 and six or eight agents were needed to mount a whole operation of that nature?
Well, the Iranians were organizing themselves. And really all they needed was support and to some extent professional guidance.
The protesters launched an attack on Mossadegh's home, forcing him to flee after a few hours' resistance. The CIA has chosen Fazlullah Zahedi as his replacement. General Zahedi, a former interior minister, had been ousted by Mossadegh 2 years earlier due to the violent unrest that took place during Harriman's visit to Iran. When Mossadegh fled his home, Zahedi, who had been hiding in the U.S. embassy, comes out to officially announce his premiership. The sad ending of this chapter of Iran's history was particularly hard for all those people who had high hopes and fought hard for the advancement of the nationalist movement in Iran, despite all the difficulties. The demonstrators who had taken to the streets during the different stages of the nationalizing of the Iranian oil industry, resisting against the threats and sanctions, and most importantly, the national uprising of July 21st, the day protesters sacrificed their blood and the blood of their beloved youths in a show of support for their prime minister. People who saw their prime minister in a position locked to their dream. By distancing himself from the spiritual leader of the nation and showing too much optimism and trust in foreign policy affairs, Mossadegh led the way to a series of events that consolidated the position of colonialism and dictatorship to continue with their atrocities against the tired body of the Iranian nation for another 25 years after the revolution.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, a nationwide annual health check of England's rivers and lakes, which used to take place annually, will now take 6 years to complete, prompting anger from both campaigners and politicians. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website of nationalworld.com has covered this story and tells us more. A health check of England's rivers and lakes has not been undertaken by the Environment Agency since 2019, according to a new investigation. Before 2016, the tests were done annually, but the government has now chosen to not deliver a complete update until 2025, a six-year delay. The 2019 assessment found that just 14% of rivers in England were in good ecological health, and none met standards for good chemical health. The watershed investigations, which works with the Wildlife Trust, found that partial results were published this month, but not flagged in the usual places on the Environment Agency or DEFRA's website. The investigation found that no chemical assessments have been made, fewer ecological tests have been taken, and no canals, coasts, transitional waters or aquifers have been tested. The lack of assessment means it is hard to know the true state of England's waterways, rivers and lakes, whether they are improving or deteriorating. However, the reduction in testing frequency is in line with official guidelines from the Water Framework Directive, the WFD. A spokesperson for DEFRA has said that the Environment Agency was legally obliged to publish a full set of data for every water body in England every 6 years. The spokesperson for DEFRA said the last full set was in 2019, with the next in 2025. However, to help with our work and that of our partners in the interim, we have recently published a limited data set that was collected between 2019 and 2021. We have deliberately targeted most of our sampling at water bodies with suspected problems so that we can get the evidence for investment, for example, from water companies and partners where it is most needed. We haven't included chemical or groundwater status, which means not all water bodies have been updated. Under the Water Framework Directive, the WFD, all water bodies were meant to meet good status by 2015, but the deadline was extended to 2027. In 2017, former Environment Agency Chair Sir James Bevan told the Government Select Committee that it would not be possible to meet the 2027 deadline, and more recently he said, the way the Water Framework Directive assessments are made needs to be changed. The former Environment Agency Chairman, Sir James Bevan, said, the one-out, all-out rule hides any improvements that are achieved across other parameters, as currently, if a water body fails on one, the whole river fails. Campaigners say there needs to be up-to-date information on the state of our rivers, as it is crucial to help us target action to protect and restore them. Ali Morse, Water Policy Manager at the Wildlife Trust, says waters are predicted to remain polluted until 2063 because of long-lasting chemicals found at every site checked, but that doesn't mean we should now stop looking. We need to take action to tackle the pollutants that we can do something about. The investigation comes after research earlier this year showed that more than 80% of England's rivers and lakes contain harmful forever chemicals. The rivers with the highest numbers of chemicals included the Mersey, the Stour, the Colne, Thames, Trent, Yare, Irwell, Medway, Humber and Avon. Dr. Rob Collins, Director of Policy and Science at the Rivers Trust, said the results are shocking and could be just the tip of the iceberg. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. A nationwide annual health check of England's water bodies, which used to take place annually, will now take 6 years to complete, prompting anger from both campaigners and politicians alike, as public alarm grows over the state of England's rivers and coasts. The assessments undertaken by the Environment Agency look at the ecological and chemical conditions of rivers, lakes, groundwater and transitional and coastal waters and are required under the Water Framework Directive, the WFD. In 2019, the last time the full assessments took place, just 14% of rivers were in good ecological health and none of the rivers met standards for good chemical health. Before 2016, the tests were done annually, but the government has now opted not to deliver a complete update until 2025, the latest permissible under the Water Framework Directive, the WFD. Clean water advocates accuse the government of trying to hide the data. Rivers activist Fergal Sharkey said, "The future of England's rivers has been sacrificed in a cynical act of self-preservation by the very same failed government agencies set up to protect them." The Green Party peer Natalie Bennett said the government clearly recognised the huge public anger about the parlous state of our waterways, but instead of taking action to clean up the rivers and lakes, it is instead trying to hide the data. Natalie Bennett added, "The stench of pollution, the choking of our waters with sewage, plastics and farm runoff is evident to all, and that the Green Party wanted to see a return to more frequent publication of the river health statistics. Democracy demands transparency, and that's one more thing this government is not delivering." The watershed investigations working with the Wildlife Trust found that partial results, about 21% of the total assessments delivered in 2019, 20,424 compared with 94,952, were published this month, but not flagged in the usual places on the Environment Agency or DEFRA's website. No chemical assessments have been made, fewer ecological tests have been carried out, and no canals, coasts, transitional waters or aquifers have been tested. The incomplete data set makes it difficult to ascertain an accurate nationwide picture of improvement or deterioration against the previous assessments of England's rivers and lakes. Although the reduction in testing frequency is in line with WFD guidelines, it has disappointed campaigners. Ali Morse, water policy manager at the Wildlife Trust, said having up-to-date data on the state of our waters is crucial to help us target action to protect and restore them. Waters are predicted to remain polluted until 2063 because of long-lasting chemicals found at every site checked. But that doesn't mean we should now stop looking. We need to take action to tackle the pollutants that we can do something about, to monitor to make sure that those aren't getting worse, and to identify any newly emerging chemicals so that we can put measures in place to prevent their further release. Ali Morse said, "The new data that exists shows that the pressure facing water bodies are not going away. The combination of issues like abstraction and pollution from farms, sewage works and urban areas mean that few rivers are healthy. In one of the worst affected areas, the Thames River Basin, 95% of the sites with new data don't meet good status, and the figures are similar for the Severn and the Anglian River Basins as well." The Liberal Democrats' environment spokesperson Tim Farron said, "This is yet more evidence of a shocking lack of transparency about the health of our rivers and lakes. The government is letting profiteering water companies get away with sewage leaks while toxic chemicals are finding their way into our rivers. We have no idea just how much pollution is in our rivers and on our beaches." The Liberal Democrats have repeatedly called for the Conservatives to take action, yet instead of doing that, they seem to be trying to hide the problem.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another edition of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we look at a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. On this edition of the program, we will be exploring the concern by many Muslims that attempts to infiltrate and destroy our religion from the inside may be well underway, and with significant Western support as well.
A popular stereotype which Muslims living in the West are routinely branded with by the mainstream media is the concept of creeping Sharia, the idea of a great Muslim conspiracy to change the West and implement their own system of governance on an unsuspecting public. However, this conspiracy